just insanity. And Mr. Usman Sonko for the last 10 years have been fighting, building awareness about Senegal to have back their economy, to have back the resources that is in this country. So Mr. Sonko is seen as someone as a liberator, because Senegalese economy for the last 64 years have been held majorly by the French companies. So I think you can actually see in the last 4 or 5 years when there were protests, you know, French companies were targeted, you know, by the youth. It's because it was about time for French to recheck their partnership they have with Senegal. But also French never condemned, you know, the dictatorship that was built in Senegal, the repression, all the act that Macky Sall in the last 12 years was doing, and before him, the other presidents. So they all had some kind of protection, you know, from France. As we speak, France has like military bases, you know, here in Senegal.
President Bassirou Diomaye Faye says he will implement a comprehensive review of oil, gas and mining contracts. He wants to enhance the state's revenue from these ventures. Now, the decision comes despite immediate former President Macky Sall warning that renegotiating existing contracts could have disastrous consequences for Senegal. Speaking after being sworn in as Senegal's fifth president, Faye spoke of change that will come under his leadership.
Je suis conscient que les résultats sortis des urnes exprime un profond désir de changement.
I am aware that the results of the ballot box express a profound desire for systematic change. Through my election, the Senegalese people have committed themselves to building a fair Senegal, a prosperous Senegal, a progressing Africa.
Now, changes or review of oil, gas and mining contracts will definitely set President Faye on a collision course with Western energy and mining multinationals. Mr. Boli, now, how do you see this unfolding? I mean, the change of or the review of the contracts?
Mr. Mubarak, if we take a look at history, you know, from the 1970s, even before that, in the 1930s, you know, when we had the bigger crisis, you know, United States of America, and later on, you know, Saudi Arabia, all the oil holding companies, you know, I mean, countries, it's normal for when we change leadership to review if everything that was signed in the name of the country was done legally or also in the benefit of the people. I don't know if you took a look at this report that was done here about 3-4 years ago by I'm not gonna do a publicity for like a major news company, but a news channel, you know, based in England, you know, that unfolded a huge scandal of $10 billion, you know, linked with the younger brother of the President Macky Sall. So we're not going to let all this go. It's actually totally normal. Those are basically part of the huge target of the actual president, the elected president, Mr. Bassirou Diomaye Jahad Faye, that is to review all this contract. That's not normally if also these companies, these major ventures, if they are here for the benefit of the win-win situation, they should not be scared. If everything was done in a good way, and Senegalese people, and also we have reviewed the law like 2 years ago, the resources are said to be for the people. So these resources, if they are for the people, is totally acceptable. And I think the investors should actually accept to come and sit on the table to review every single contract that was signed in this last year, you know, regarding the Senegalese resources, gas, oil, gold, or everything.
French capitalism still super exploits Senegal and other ex-colonies, including compelling use of the CFA franc currency. He proposes introducing a new currency instead of the CFA franc that is backed by the French Treasury and used in 14 member countries. This move is expected to have regional implications.
This is not a radical move, Mr. Mubarak. This is actually a great historical and it's about time. You know, radicalism is something that, you know, people will put in a concept, you know, that people are like populist. We are not populist. We are very smart people. 2021 and 2022, normally we were supposed to start like a currency called ECO. It didn't start because French implication with Ivory Coast and Senegal majorly, These are the two countries that influence, you know, the beginning of this currency. If you even look at the franc CFA, it's historically and socially, it doesn't connect with us. It doesn't connect with this old currency. This currency is still called CFA. CFA is the franc of French colonies in Africa. So how can we even continue using a money that linked to colonialism?
Faye is the youngest ever president of this West African nation. Now, many young people in Africa have lost hope due to bad governance and poverty in the continent. The election of Faye has ignited hope in Senegal and indeed across Africa. President Faye says that Senegal will now be a country of hope. Let's take a listen.
Le Sénégal, sous mon magistère, sera un pays d'espérance.
Under my leadership, Senegal will be a country of hope, a country at peace, with an independent justice system and a strengthened democracy. This is my promise, based on the oath I have just taken before God and the nation in your presence.
And now our last question to Galissa. Now, what does the election of Faye mean for Africa, a continent with the youngest population in the world? Now, are we going to see more young leaders emerging in Africa in future?
Yes, I think we are. It's a great message to the continent. It's a great message to the world. As you said, Africa is the youngest continent, and we are even projecting by 2050 that Africa will be the biggest population in the world, and it will be, again, that will mean, you know, the youngest, you know, continent and the biggest population. So if that's the case today, it's to say to the rest of the continent that all the youth that are being held, that are being said that you cannot or you are not capable of leading, that has to end. Today, in Senegal, we have about 65 to 70% of the population that is young, between 18 to 25, and about 75% that are young, between 18 to 35, you know, years old. So it's a great message. It's an absolutely incredible, you know, historical time for Senegal and for the continent. And also, it's a moment to liberate all this talent, all this belief that people had, to tell them, no, you can, and go forward. Try to fight for democracy. Try to fight for your political belief, and go ahead. Don't listen to people that are saying that you guys are too young, you cannot be president, or you cannot be prime minister, or you cannot be the president of the Congress, the House, the Legislative House. So I think Senegalese people electing the youngest president in the country right now, it's a great message to the youth. It's about time for them to stop, like, taking the road of immigration, to not believing in themselves, to say that, you know, no, there's no hope for me in my country or in my continent. I need to go somewhere else to try to make a better living.
A strong message there to young people across Africa that if they believe in themselves, then they will achieve their dreams inside Africa. I would like to thank our guest there, Galissa Boly, for his incisive analysis on the recent presidential election in Senegal. Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. From me, Mubarak Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
French police have risked the lives of migrants trying to cross the English Channel to the United Kingdom in small boats by using dangerous tactics, including puncturing boats and threatening migrants with pepper spray. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. French police, funded by the UK government, have endangered the lives of vulnerable migrants by intercepting small boats in the English Channel, using tactics that search and rescue experts say could cause a mass casualty event. Shocking new evidence obtained by The Guardian, Lighthouse reports, Le Monde and Der Spiegel reveals for the first time that the French maritime police have tried physically to force small boats to turn around, manoeuvres known as pullbacks, in an attempt to prevent them reaching British shores. Newly obtained video footage, leaked documents and witness testimonies show that the French authorities have used aggressive tactics, including circling a migrant boat, causing waves to flood the dinghy, ramming into a small boat whilst threatening passengers with a large tank of pepper spray, and puncturing boats when they are already at sea, forcing migrants to swim back to shore. The French authorities have previously refused Britain's request for them to carry out interceptions at sea, stating that they contravened international maritime law. But evidence indicates there has been an escalation in the use of these tactics since last summer. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has pledged to stop the boats crossing the Channel and has promised hundreds of millions of pounds to France to pay for more surveillance and border guards to prevent people making the journey. Recently, the government's Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill suffered several defeats in the House of Lords, delaying the Prime Minister's plan to see flights for Kigali take off until after Easter. Ministers claim that the bill will act as a deterrent to all those crossing the Channel from northern France to Britain. In the first video obtained and verified for this investigation, a police boat in Dunkirk Harbour circles close to a dinghy holding about 25 people, creating a wake that floods the boat. The police vessel is seen advancing towards the dinghy at speed before turning sharply to create waves, circling and coming back again. Migrants are seen wearing foam-packed life jackets and attempting to bail water out using their shoes. Sources have confirmed that the police patrol vessel used to carry out the manoeuvre seen in the video was brought by the French authorities with funding provided by the British government under the Sandhurst Treaty, a bilateral border security deal signed at the Royal Military Academy in 2018. One search and rescue expert who was shown the video footage said, "This is a textbook pushback, exactly the same as we have seen in Greece," adding that one manoeuvre alone could cause a mass casualty event. The water is deep enough to drown in. "I've seen this in the central Mediterranean many times, but this is the first time that I've seen anything like this happening in the English Channel." Previous evidence has shown how the Greek Coast Guard has forced boats carrying migrants back into the Turkish waters in the Aegean Sea, in some cases by manoeuvring around them at high speed to create waves. Two senior British Border Force sources confirmed that the tactic could lead to multiple deaths and injuries. One operational Border Force official said, "If the blades of the French boat make contact with the vessel, it will slash right through the vessel," adding, "The other thing is a collision. The weight and the force of that vessel could ride straight over the top of the rib. it would knock the passengers out, knock them unconscious and into the water. It could potentially lead to a large number of deaths. I can't believe any mariner could condone that. Maritime experts added that they would be very surprised if Border Force and HM Coast Guard were not aware of these tactics being used, with one adding, 100%, someone high up will definitely be aware of this. In a second video clip, members of the French gendarmerie drive along a dinghy in a speedboat about 12 miles from the French coast, threatening to use a large tank of pepper spray against a boat carrying migrants. They then proceed to ram their vessel into the dinghy. A Border Force official said they don't even know who's on board, whether there's someone asthmatic that they're using pepper spray against, or pregnant women, adding that could really harm people. In evidence of a third attempted pullback, a complaint filed by a member of the French Customs Coast Guard to the public prosecutor in Boulogne-sur-Mer charged that on 11th of August 2023, police officers ordered a National Society of Sea Rescue's crew to puncture a small boat that had already set sail. In an email seen by this investigation, the complainant, Remy van der Plaak, states that the National Society of Sea Rescue's crew obviously refused to do this, adding that the risk of drowning if they had done so was obvious and imminent. Testimony from several sources who boarded small boats bound for Britain support the claims that French police have used such tactics. One man who was from India said, "There were four of them, French gendarmes, on the boat. They went around the boat in a circle and then they stabbed the boat and left. We had to swim for about 10 minutes. We nearly died." On 9th of February 2024, the man lodged a complaint with the French Human Rights Ombudsman. The incident is currently under investigation. The website Politico has also covered the same story and tells us more. Sources within France's Interior Ministry have described the British government's enormous pressure on a daily basis for the French Maritime Police to prevent small boat departures, with one French civil servant describing the pressure as intense and non-stop. Another senior civil servant who was in post until the end of 2020 added, "As far as the British were concerned, the boats had to be caught at sea. They sometimes insisted on it." In September of last year, the then British Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick, said in the House of Commons that there is clearly more that we need the French to do for us, pointing to a recent trip to Belgium, where he said the authorities had been willing to intercept in the water small boats leaving its shores. Robert Jenrick added, "That has proven decisive. Small boats from Belgian waters are now extremely rare, so that is an approach that we encourage the French to follow." In August of 2021, during a visit to the Greek island of Samos, then Home Secretary Priti Patel went out on patrol with the Greek Coast Guard, which is known for its use of aggressive pushbacks in the Aegean Sea. A Home Office source with knowledge of the trip said she came back invigorated, adding, "They were very aggressive, had a good success rate of detection, and were swift in how they processed them, the asylum seekers." She liked their posturing of protecting borders and working with the military, though there was recognition that a lot of this wouldn't be lawful in Britain. Britain has allocated more than £700 million to France to prevent irregular migration since 2014. At a summit in March of 2023, Prime Minister Sunak announced that Britain would give France £500 million over 3 years to fund additional border guards and a new detection facility, as well as video surveillance cameras, drones and night vision binoculars, among other equipment.
citizens under surveillance.
To watch without being seen, that's the spirit of surveillance. It's always present in the citizens' lives, but in the past 10 years, along with the pace of technological advances, we have witnessed a revolution. Targeted surveillance has gradually turned into mass surveillance worldwide. In the past, it only focused on public areas, but now it's violating our privacy. Closing the door or drawing the curtains at home is not enough anymore. The invisible eye is settled in our privacy. Online items and games, activities on social networks, local details of our smartphones, and inquiries on the search engines. Our online life turns into data. The information that, when processed, makes a new form of identity on which we have no control. Our private life could be laid bare in a matter of moments. This is what we will watch in this preventive film. A few minutes would be enough for four hackers to tap into all this information. This experience is a warning. Our online life doesn't belong to us. Never have we been scrutinized so much. 70% of our calls by mobile phones are recorded. Millions of hours of discussion by webcam are diverted by the secret services. Our existence is now accessible on the internet in the form of databases, and every single detail of our lives is retained in the memories by the storage centers. Who records this valuable information? How is it exploited, and for what purposes? We have conducted a survey for 2 years in Europe and in the United States. We went to meet the experts in digital surveillance, hackers and whistleblowers, and also the web giants such as Google or Facebook, and also the secret services that process and collect our data. As the boundaries between surveillance, technology and power fade, we will see that the gap is growing between two groups. On one side, defenders of individual freedoms, and on the other, supporters of cyber surveillance. A paradigm shift that can lead the citizens towards a new social model.
I think, you know, our modern societies are facing a choice about the future, and I think it's fundamentally a political choice. I think we could decide through an action to say, well, you know, we don't care very much about this. We don't care very much if the government gathers up all this information. We don't care very much about who has access to it, how it's used. We don't care if our children grow up in such a world of constant surveillance. And I think that could happen.
We abandon a part of our freedoms by accepting to be monitored in our private lives. In the field of surveillance, two viewpoints are nowadays coexisting and competing in the world. Some are rebelling against these violations of privacy in the name of individual freedom, while others consider technological developments as a preferred means of strengthening the security level. The United States, where the public domain may be monitored without any legal authorization, has developed an initiative for the pioneer collective surveillance, the NOLA Project. Citizens are at the heart of this community video surveillance project. The word security is increasingly associated with surveillance. We went to meet one of the world's leading researchers in this field. Sociologist David Lyon, a professor at the University of Kingston, leads the research laboratory of surveillance, where he has studied for 20 years the impacts of surveillance on our lifestyles.
There are questions about some balance or some tension between liberty on the one hand and privacy on the other, or security and liberty. There are various ways in which this debate is located. However, it seems to me that, again, the big questions still need to be asked.
And it was to protect our privacy that on September 5, 2001, only a few days before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the European Union was going to adopt the historical sanctions against the United States in order to make it cease the large-scale spying on phone calls and fax messages, and especially to make it give up the establishment of email surveillance. Europe knew that since the Second World War, the NSA, along with the intelligence services of its Anglo-Saxon allies, monitored the old continent under a program called Echelon.
This new law that I signed today will allow surveillance of all communications used by terrorists, including emails, the internet, and cell phones. As of today, we'll be able to better meet the technological challenges posed by this proliferation of communications technology.
I don't think there's any effort or reasonable likelihood that the entire population of the United States could be controlled on pretty much anything. But in many cases, you do have to look at all of the information about the entire population in order to find people who are trying very hard to escape your notice, to try to hide from you. And often it is only when you look at the entire population that the people who are the riskiest, you don't know that they're guilty of anything, but you know that they are riskier than others, can get the attention that they deserve.
Tout est connecté. Feu de circulation. Caméra de surveillance.
Watchdogs is the playful extension of our hyper-connected society. A world in which everyone leaves behind them a thick cloud of clues, useful data, and potential incriminatory information. A world where all the connected objects are all spies, which record our slightest facts and gestures continuously.
Everything and everyone is connected. You can hack into anyone's life. Tap their phones, their music, their accounts. Identify criminals, disrupt communications, roadways, infiltrate private homes.
I suspect that players are going to finish the game, pick up their phone, and immediately make that hard connection between our game world and the world outside. There's not a big line between the two. You know, we're heavily connected with the real world in ways we never expected. We never expected we'd be this.
I know the truth. I know how you think. I see the digital shadow you cast. You lie to everyone else. You can't hide from me.
But which part of our lives would be accessible in this way, unveiling our privacy and our conducts? Kenneth Cuckier, the data editor of The Economist and a former technology editor for the Wall Street Journal Asia, has investigated the traces that we leave in our online life. The facts foreshadow a new form of surveillance.
That information, which is far, far larger than it ever has been in the past, because we now have the mechanisms to collect it, store it, and process it, and there's an economic incentive to do so as well, because it's very valuable information, this huge data avatar that follows us around, sort of like a spirit of Greek mythology, we're aware still of our physicality. We're still primed in that universe, in our thinking. And because we don't see it, we don't understand that this great data penumbra behind us is much larger, much more valuable, and we can't protect it.
But how should we shape our digital shadow? No one can imagine what lies behind a simple internet connection. The Kukovits software, made available to the citizens by the CNIL, the French National Commission for Information Technology and Civil Liberties, allows us to spot the digital spies who come to be set on our IP address to spy on us. These little spies, known as cookies, provide the raw materials for statistics and analysis corporations. Within the first few minutes of our connection, for example, to an information site about trading, a myriad of cookies detect our presence and record our data. Each blue point is a private company that spies on our internet browsing. Our actions transform to some data are a gold mine for Facebook. This social network, on its website, Facebook for Business, which is destined for the companies, shows off its treasury of the personalized profiles that are its members. Find new customers, increase sales. What interests Facebook is the special profiling which is advertised by us, a perfectly targeted audience. More than a billion people are online through Facebook. An invisible monitoring which allows personalized advertising. For example, the category of wealthy, a prime target for certain advertisers, corresponds with 13% of the richest French people. Almost half of them are on Facebook. 3 million wealthy people on Facebook. Wealthy people use Facebook all day long. And the site, which scrutinizes their tastes and their everyday activities, knows how to evaluate their probability of purchasing different types of products. A more than 30% chance of buying cosmetics, costing more than 75 euros. More than 33% of dresses costing more than 1,000 euros, and an over 40% chance of buying watches costing more than 750 euros. This unprecedented qualitative rise in the analysis and tracing of activities can influence the purchasing power of more than 1.3 billion users who are offered individualized advertising. This capability attracts the biggest global brands and renders Facebook an internet giant. Beside the superiors of Silicon Valley, namely Apple, Google, and Amazon, known as GAFA, they establish a quartet with a market capitalization more than $1.5 trillion, a number larger than that of the four main international oil companies. And the data, which are the assets of these companies, are destined to grow exponentially through the online devices which are going to facilitate our lives and spy on all of our activities. This enormous amount of data, some billions per second, is sorted in what the internet operators call the cloud. Although this commercial name suggests that there is no material trace of our data, this cloud hides a physical storage as well. In a storage place, protected as a military base and inaccessible to journalists, all the data collected from the Google applications are copied, stored, and processed. Emails, photos, videos, browsing on the search engines, all our digital fingerprints are retained in these industrial buildings established in every corner of the world, and they're all interconnected.
One of the remarkable facts is that companies can easily know more about you than you know about yourself. I mean, consider Google, for example. It keeps your search history, everything you've been interested in for the last 5 years. I can't remember everything I was interested in for the last week. But if someone were to go to Google and say, well, what has this person been looking at, and what kinds of, you know, political beliefs do they have, and what are their goals, and what are their concerns? Google could likely answer that question for anybody more fully than any of us could about ourselves. And I think that's part of this reality, at least in the current day. I'd like to see that change. I'd like it to be the case that whatever a company knows about us, we would know as well.
Thus, we leave an ineffaceable mark of our actions, our travels, our opinions, and our desires. But what will happen if at some point we want to access this black box that archives our online lives? What will happen if we want to withdraw or modify the information that's about us? In Coronia, we met with the first citizen to bring an issue before the European court. Maria Costea Gonzalez is a graphologist in Coronia. In 1998, his apartment was auctioned off to cover his social security debts. So the legal notice was published in the regional newspaper La Vanguardia. In 2007, when the newspaper digitized its archives, Mario was automatically associated with this case on the first page of Google when he searched his name. Appealing for the right of privacy against a search engine that accounts for 97% of the searches in Europe seems to be a mission impossible. Maria Castella's petition could have shaken the Silicon Valley giant to the core. After 6 months of negotiations with Google, we could finally find a way to enter their campus and meet with David Drummond, their vice president in charge of legal affairs.
We have to strike a balance between privacy on the one hand, information on the other hand, innovation on the other hand. And so what's important is to make sure that we are protecting users' privacy, that users have choice and have transparency. So they know what is going on, they have the ability to change what's going on, and change settings, share the sharing of information is under their control. What we don't want to do is just ban the use of data, because data can be very important for society. And there are lots of innovations we can do that can move society forward, whether it's in the medical sphere and applying what so-called big data to important medical problems, and many other things. So we want to make sure that we have the freedom to innovate. But we should be clear that there are rules that involve user choice and transparency and the ability to change things.
In front of the giants of the internet, what is the scope of maneuvering in controlling their personal data for the citizens' consumers?
Seen from those internet giants, national rules are fragments, are nuisances, and that's very annoying. So there is a driving from this idea of individuals having to stay in control of their own data. There is a very fundamental question about democracy, the rule of law. Who is in control of values in a society?
A journey through the desert begins for Maria. Very few lawyers agree to be involved in what they already know is a lost case. He was turned down by some 20 lawyers before a young lawyer agreed to take on his case. Mr. Munaz, a specialist in new technologies, decided to speak out about what even the states didn't still dare put into question blatantly. The Spanish Agency for Data Protection, whose mission is to be watchful of citizen privacy, joined Mario's petition against Google. Maria Costea is the first citizen to bring an action before the European Court of Justice. Google played its best trumps against him. Francisco Diaz, former European Commissioner Mario Monti's right-hand man, became the lawyer of the large monopoly groups. He manages a group of about 10 lawyers. The Grand Inquisitor, a Spanish, defends Google in Brussels.
option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and teenagers, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed light on this important subject. Salaamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So we have a question that we had been discussing in the past sessions, and it was about a 15-year-old daughter who doesn't talk about her problems to her mother. And the mother was concerned about how she should, you know, go about it. And you had given us very good tips, one of which was, you know, we have to try and be positive, we have to do active listening. Do you have anything more to say?
Yes, we talked about the fact that when a parent wants to talk to her teenage, a mother wants to talk to her teenage, she should capture a moment when the teenage feels like talking. Sometimes it so happens then that the mother wants to, or the father wants to talk to them, but they're not in a mood of talking. So we should respect those moments of them, their privacies. True. Maybe they're so bottled up inside that they don't feel like, you know, relating and showing their weaknesses. Or maybe they feel like, you know, just talking to themselves, you can say, or just sleeping over it and forgetting a little about the pain. But then it happens so that they forget and they are easy a bit when time passes. And then when they so happen to want to talk about it, you know, because if they see that there is so much compassion at home, then they know that their parents relate to them, especially the mother. So she will, a teenage girl especially, would feel like talking, and she would then, you know, like ask the parent to listen to them. And therefore, this mother who wants to talk to her, whatever she be doing at that time, she should leave. Of course, apart from the other things that are so wajib, like prayer and everything. But true, of course, yeah, at that time, she should, you know, like capture that moment and
yeah, and I think also helps remove the barrier, because sometimes those barriers are built between the parents and children, because the children, the teenagers feel like the parents just don't understand them.
Yes.
They don't respect their, you know, boundaries and etc. So,
and why do they think that their friends do? It's because their friends do active listening.
Mm.
They're so like, you know, eager, and they're so willing to listen.
True.
And they, you know, they share those sorrows with them also. So they know that there's a listening ear, and the best is the parent if she gives that listening ear. And mostly parents do that, but sometimes it happens so that the parents forget about this thing. They don't capture themselves as being young, you know, one day. One day all of us, the parents were also young, and they don't know how it feels to be in the skin of a young person.
Very true.
You know, they forget about it.
And I think sometimes parents resort to giving solutions straight away, or they judge them, or the teenagers feel judged. And
yes,
usually
yes,
from their friends,
absolutely,
they feel like, okay, now they understand.
Yes,
me.
They don't judge them, exactly. So this is one part of active listening.
Yeah.
And then we talked about positive, being positive. Always look at the bright side of things.
Yeah.
You know, like if we are so much negative ourselves, then the child will take that negative energy and feel more sorrowful over what matter they are maybe, you know, like feeling sad over.
True.
So however much at home we are supposed to be positive, to bring that positive nature about it, like, what a good day I had today, such and such good thing happened. Maybe, for example, we did a good thing in the morning, and then we enjoyed our breakfast. When we went, we saw this, and we admired the beauty of the nature, or whatever be it, you know, some things that need to be mostly pumped in, like to the youth, that to bring about that positive nature at home.
True.
It's very important.
I think the vibe is very important.
Yes, the vibe.
So we'll just take a quick break and pick up shortly.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio, and we have been discussing about one of the questions that had been previously asked about a mother worried about her 15-year-old daughter who doesn't talk about her problems to her mother anymore. And you gave some very informative lessons in how to deal with the teenagers. So did you want to expand on those?
Yes. Another way to open up a conversation with her teenage daughter is maybe focus on their interests. This is very important, that, you know, when a person is interested in something and probably you are not, you shouldn't, you know, forego that as something that, or take it for granted.
Yeah.
For example, if your daughter is interested in crafts work or maybe some creativity or artwork or cooking or, you know, anything, reading, so know that subject as, you know, take it seriously. I guess when a parent is really caring, it happens.
Yeah.
That when a parent is caring, they see even the boy's interest or the girl's interest, and they search on that, and they want to see more on that, maybe documentaries or read about it, and then talk to them about it. Yeah. So they know that this, my parent is sharing my interests with me.
True.
So they have more to talk about. So what happens is that when they see that the small stuff is not taken for granted, you know, like small hobbies or things that they like, or remembering their favorite color, remembering their favorite dish and things like that, or what they like and discussing about it and giving a comment on that, they know that the parents share their interests about the small stuff, so they will also resort to in the big matters.
Very like, true. You know? I think many teenagers go through this, that you know, nobody understands me and nobody really cares for me. And however much you go and tell them, no, we care, no,
yeah,
they have to see
that's
through
not
action.
Enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So when parents actually show interest in what they're doing, not just for the sake of it, no, actual interest. And teenagers are very smart. Yeah, they know when the parents are just saying,
yeah,
or actually,
exactly, yeah,
feeling or doing something for,
yeah,
the sake of that.
It's so nice that if a daughter is so much, you know, like taken up with the interests of the parent. Like sometimes, you know, in creativity, a mother likes to stitch, so the child even feels that, you know, urge to,
yeah,
want to explore that field and stitch and everything. So both can discuss so well on that matter, or cooking or anything, reading, for instance, or, you know, like matters that are like political matters of the day-to-day time, and they can discuss on that too, or a subject for that matter, for example, English literature or literary subject like Nahjul Balagha,
yeah,
the eloquence of it, and, you know, parents, or Quran, for instance. Parents can discuss so much with the children, you know, that really gives a big you know, heart to the parents especially. But you know, however, we say that if the child has different interests, probe on those interests and see what the goodness comes out of it. And maybe here and there you can comment on that, and you can ask them, have you discovered this part of your interest, you know,
yeah,
and this part, this interest of yours has these kind of advantages, or what did you do about it, maybe, what have you done anything new you know, like exactly. For example, art is concerned. It's a very good, you know, like talent. But of course, it has to be like taken seriously and discussed about and shown interest.
Very true, very true. So let's just have a short break and we will continue shortly.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back, and we have been discussing about what to do to have a better relation with your teenage children especially. And Sister Selma has been telling us a lot about how to deal with that, you know, focus on their interests, show interest in their interests, and that will really build a bond.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you want to say more on that?
Yes. Another thing that I want to point out is avoid talking too much. Although we just discussed about how there should be a verbal interaction between the parent and the child, the teenager, that, you know, you have to know about their interests and everything. But here, avoid talking too much in the other times.
Yeah.
For example, however much you speak to an adult who's your age or something, try to, you know, hear out more from your teenager.
True.
In fact, even from your children, they have so much to let out, their energy and everything, and then you should lend the listening ear, and especially teenagers don't like you to advise them and to give a lecture, or, you know, like talking too much in the sense of giving them a lecture, or, you know, even telling them about your own things.
Yeah.
They like to be listened to. And in fact, this is a universal thing, yeah? If you go and see, mostly people, when they're listened to actively, they really appreciate that more than when you give your opinions,
true.
Even a friend, even somebody who is a soulmate, your best friend.
Your husband.
Yeah, they listen to you. You would appreciate them more. So avoid talking too much and, you know, excessively also. And also questioning them. That why did you do this? Why don't you do this? Why did you, you know, you made your own mistakes. So judging them.
Yeah.
They would repel from that. And they would feel that, you know, just to turn a deaf ear on whatever we are saying.
True.
And they would not confide then. So to want to make a teenager talk to you is that try to talk less and listen more.
Yep. Showing that interest,
yeah.
Showing that,
yes.
You know, I'm here for you,
yeah.
And giving that full attention.
And also that you are supposed to talk more than me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then another thing is that admitting our mistakes. Sometimes when we make mistakes, we don't admit them, they pile up. When they pile up, the teenager feels that, you know, my mother is always in cross with me.
Yeah.
And she's always at loggerheads with me. So I can't relate to her. But if you admit your mistakes, then they know even how to admit their mistakes.
True.
They know that it's nothing wrong to do that. And that's why we have rights of a child also. Rights of a... And especially when it comes to adult child, like, for example, a teenager is now has the right mind to decide between right and wrong. So he sees or she sees what's going on. And they don't like some things. So we shouldn't say that it's a child. He's my child. I have authority over them.
Yeah.
You know? Although you have guidance and you share more authority, but you have no right to, for example, tease them or, you know, pass a comment that makes them feel hurt. So you should... Like, even if you, for example, sometimes, you know, parents tend to joke about maybe the clothing style or the hairstyle. So the girl especially takes it very much at heart.
Yeah.
So this needs to be corrected before it's too late. So the parent should be sensitive enough to see what makes them feel bad, what makes them, you know, like comments that we talk to our friends about our girls when they are nearby.
Yeah.
So that we should be very careful and hypersensitive about it. That what makes our children feel bad, we should not, stake that with the
relationship.
Yeah,
I agree. I remember even when I was a child, if even though there was something very simple, very small, you know, it wasn't even very important, but as soon as my parents would, you know, joke about it, I would take it very much to heart. Like, I'd feel like they're disrespecting me when they had no intention whatsoever. And after that, I think because my mother made a bond with me, I was able to communicate that. And then she realized, okay, no, then we shouldn't bring these matters about. And alhamdulillah, that really, you know, put my self-esteem up, because otherwise it's very easy to get a low self-esteem from that young age if the parents, you know, joke about them or tease their children too much with a good heart. But it has its, you know, its stakes,
yes,
as you said.
So last but not least, we should also consider one point, and that's very important for all ages, not only teenagers, in fact for adults as well, is that you should remind them that you love them. And not just, you know, oh, just remember that I love you. No, it's concentrating on that, pointing out the qualities, what you like, what you appreciate, and also acknowledge the fact that, you know, you receive that love from them. So it's not just one-sided, it should be two-sided. Acknowledge it, yeah? That remind them that how important they are in your lives. Remind them all these things so that they can feel that, empowered. Because love is the only thing that really empowers a person.
True.
Yeah, they'll feel so much trust and satisfaction, and of course they'll have a better relationship with the parents as life goes on. Mostly, if you go and see when teenagers grow up to be adults, they say they were not close with their parents. And it's really a sad thing, to hear that a girl is not close to her parent. Why? It's because there was this communication gap between them. But the parent has to remind that, remember, you are very important for me. You know, we think that it's just small children who need to be cuddled and loved and hugged, but it's also elder children.
Definitely.
They need to have that even probably more, because they shouldn't look for it outside. You know, they know that they have a very strong relationship with their, at least one of their parents. They know that they confide. They know that they can even embrace them and hug them and, you know, feel relaxed with them. So the parents should never refrain from that.
Very true, very true. So that was very, very insightful. And thank you very much for your valuable time, Sister Salma. And we hope to see you in the next episode. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. You've just listened to IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. And if you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI. Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Just one day after France's foreign minister earned praise for saying that sanctions on Israel could be coming over their refusal to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza, he quickly backtracked in a session before Parliament. Many are saying the episode revealed the uniquely powerful sway Zionism has in France.
France, although it has the biggest Jewish community in Europe, has also the most extreme right-wing anti-Palestinian Jewish community in Europe. And this this Jewish community in France has a lot of saying and a lot of control over the media, over the political class. So you have very few people within this community who are protesting what's going on in the Middle East. Not like the United States and Great Britain.
The majority of France's Jews fled from former French colonies in Africa once those countries gained independence in the 1950s and 1960s, and they reportedly brought with them stringent anti-Arab and pro-imperialist views. In 2019, French Parliament controversially and incorrectly equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and they are currently reviewing a proposal to fully criminalize anti-Zionism.
They're saying straight, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Therefore, any criticism of Zionism, any criticism of Israel, means you are a criminal because you're an anti-Semite. And so it's killing all debate. Now, all throughout the collective West, but especially in France, the number one threat to freedom of speech